Goeienaand, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Ons gaan vanaand oor ons son praat en meer spesifiek met Jim Adams oor die sendings na die son en wat met die son te doen het. Maar voordat eers ruimte nuus, wat geskryf is deur Herman Torin in Bloemfontein. Straks lê 'n lang soektog nog voor na die moontlike letsels van 'n blitsvinnige meteoriet wat naby die Noorse hoofstad Oslo in 'n dig beboude gebied geval het. Kennis meen het kan selfs 'n dekade neem om die ruimterommel se oorblyfsels te vind. Die voorwerp het 'n soniese ontploffing afgegee toe dit die atmosfeer teen ongeveer 722.000 km per uur deurklief het. Jeff Bezos, grootbaas van New Horizons, het 'n beroep op NASA gedoen om sy maatskappy te oorweeg vir die bou van die maanvoertuig te tender. Bezos is bereid dat sy maatskappy so wat 2 biljoen Amerikaanse dollar van die tenderprys self dra, omdat so 'n kontrak waardevol sal wees vir ander ruimtenavorsing waarmee New Horizons reeds besig is. Die navorsing is deel van 'n toutrekkery tussen Blue Horizons en Elon Musk se deelname aan die VSA se nuwe Artemis-program om die eerste maan-ekspedisie mee op te volg. Die strydende partye beskuldig mekaar van voortrekbehandeling en dat spesiale behandeling tot 'n groot vertraging van die program kan lei. Die kontrak is reeds aan Musk toegeken. Tot sover dan ruimte nuus, wat geskryf is deur Herman Torin in Bloemfontein. Hier is Kobus Olkers nou weer met ruimte weer nuus.
Goeienaand en goeienaand luisteraars. Ja, nuwe week, nuwe besighede op die son. Kom ons kyk 'n bietjie wat lê vir ons voor hierdie week. Wat ons hierdie week gehad het, dit was soos voorspel, was dit nogal redelik besig met 'n bietjie koronagat aktiwiteit. Dit is nou besig om weg te gaan, af te spin van die son se skyf af, wat na die aarde toewys. Ons het nog twee redelike komplekse groot magnetiese areas op die kant van die son. Hulle is gelukkig nie kompleks genoeg dat hulle energie het vir koronamassa uitbarstings nie. Tenminste nie enigiets wat genoeg energie het om ons veel te pla nie. Op die SOHO se koronagraaf kan ons hierdie week duidelik sien hoe daar 'n uitbarsting weggekom het van die son, maar hy was van die kant en hy is dan na Mercurius se koers toe. So hulle het 'n bietjie son weer daar gehad. Nou ja, hier na ons kant, soos ek sê, het ons twee pragtige areas as 'n mens by die gaan kyk na die SDO satelliet se webwerf, van kan mens pragtige mooi bo sien soos wat hulle daar sit op die rand van die son. Ons son het baie vinnig gespring van amper geen aktiwiteit toe nie na heelwat aktiwiteit toe. Die ruimte weer hier by ons word gelukkig nie veel beïnvloed met hierdie pragtige mooi beelde wat ons sien nie. Ek sien geen vooruitsigte vir groot koronamassa uitbarstings of koronagate hier na ons geweste toe vir die volgende week of so nie. So daar het ons dit vir hierdie week. Geen probleme nie, geen vooruitgeskatte probleme selfs nie, kanse vir enige aktiwiteit is baie skraal. So as ons luisteraars internet of enige GPS of enige van hierdie apparate moeilikheid gee hierdie week, ons kan nie die son blameer nie. Goeienaand allemaal en 'n wonderlike week voor.
Dankie Kobus. Jim Adams daar in Amerika is by ons. Goeienaand Jim.
Goeienaand, Henny.
En Willy Koorts, hy sit natuurlik in, ek weet nie, jy is nie nou by Sutherland nie, ne?
Goeienaand, ja nee, ek is nou nie in Sutherland nie, ek is weer terug hier nie, in die beskawing, as jy dit so wil noem, ja.
Nou so van Sutherland gepraat, we know that we mentioned it in passing that Willy was busy helping a dome construction at Sutherland. Will it take us through that? How far is this this project?
Yes, there were actually two projects. The one we mentioned before, and Jim is actually half involved. Well, not really involved, but he's been. Yeah, he can maybe explain what his involvement is there.
I'm the grandfather of it.
The grandfather.
The Atlas
project and the mount for the telescope has actually since arrived. And the telescope itself, I think, has been shipped. So that as far as I know, is that's sort of on its way. And then suddenly I became an expert in building domes, being the only person in South Africa, well, one of a handful of people who've built domes in South Africa. And then, so there's another project called PRIME. It stands for Prime Focus Infrared Micro Lensing Experiment. Quite a big telescope, 1.8 meter and fast in optical terms, f2.2. And it's got a field of view of about 3 degrees, which is massive for a telescope of that size. It'll work mainly in the infrared, and it'll also sport an infrared spectrograph, which you don't find on many telescopes around the world. So there has been a telescope there for about 20 years called the IRSF, run by the Japanese Infrared Survey Facility. And this is sort of the upgrade to it in one instance. And interestingly enough as well is that the WFIRST Infrared Space Telescope that's due to be launched. Well, it's now renamed to the, in honor of Nancy Roman. There will be a lot of collaboration between these projects, because they will be supplementing and complementing each other. Yeah. So this has been, they started building this in fact, at the same time we started the Prime, Atlas Dome actually. And on my video on YouTube, you can actually see in the background, you can see there's a crane busy working and what. Anyway, so then there was a shortage of steel in South Africa in the beginning of this year. And the telescope was delayed slightly, waiting for steel. And then they got to a point where they had to install things like the electrical stuff and so forth and the dome was still open. It needed the actual dome to be put on top of it. So then I got involved and I got a firm who built telescopes in Sutherland about 10 years ago, constructed these prefabricated domes that comes all the way from America. In fact, the dome arrived on site the day that lockdown started back in the BC years, you know, before COVID years. So then we constructed the dome in about 2 weeks. And then we needed a big crane to put it on, a 40-ton crane. The dome itself only weighs about 4 tons, but the reason for the 40-ton is because you have to have the reach to get it open, to get it up and on top of the building. And that was completed about a month ago now. And now the construction is busy, is continuing again. The telescope is actually on site already. On the videos, you'll see some crates in the field. And there are crates under roof as well. So the telescope and the equipment built by Nishimura in Japan has already been shipped and awaiting now the building to be finished.
Fantastic. I saw the videos. I believe you posted links to the RSG Facebook group.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very, very big dome. So.
It is quite big. I forgot the size, but it's basically 10 meters in diameter, basically. Yeah, it's massive.
Wow.
Right. So. From the one dome, let's move to another dome. Actually, it's not a dome. It's a sphere. We call it the sun. We've often spoken about solar storms in this program. And you were, Jim, involved with quite a number of so-called solar missions. Before you talk about the missions, tell us about what exactly is, in your mind, a solar storm?
Oh, yeah. So, in fact, the sun is not just a single solitary static yellow disk. It's this ball of plasma that's rotating, and the equator and the poles of this ball of plasma rotate at different speeds. And so when you have charged particles moving, you create a current. Currents create magnetic fields. What happens is these magnetic fields, they want to align. They want to stay, you know, straight together. And what happens because of the rotation of the sun, the differential rotation of the sun, these magnetic fields get all tangled up. And eventually what happens is the surface of the sun can't stand it anymore, and it releases big chunks of the sun's corona. And they call those coronal mass ejections. And a coronal mass ejection then goes hurtling out into space at something on the order of 1,000,000 miles an hour. So it takes a few days actually to get out to the Earth's orbit. And sometimes the Earth is in the exact spot to interact with that material that got pushed off of the sun due to the arguments, if you will, of the magnetic fields. Those charged particles then interact with the Earth's magnetic field and create what we refer to as the aurora borealis. It also can create ground currents and interfere with electrical grid disruptions as well as communications, and in some extreme cases create radiation doses that are higher than normal for the International Space Station and high-flying aircraft and that sort of thing. So a few years ago, well, actually 20 years ago or so, there was this discipline that developed that has now become an international research area called space weather. And space weather is all about trying to predict the impact of the solar dynamics on the Earth and how that, you know, how we can warn people in the event that there might be some sort of upcoming problem. And in fact, on July 23rd, they noted that there was a minor coronal mass ejection that happened, and it was coming, was on a path to intersect with the Earth and get caught up in our magnetic field. So there was an alert sent out and people got ready, and pretty much nothing happened. It was just a passing storm. It wasn't a real big one, but we are ready. And I guess I should say one of the important Southern Hemisphere research centers for solar physics and space weather is actually in South Africa in Hermanus, hosted by the SANSA facility there.
Right. Now we know a lot about solar storms, yeah. The solar missions. I think the latest one was or is the Parker mission, isn't it?
Parker Solar Probe. But and that's one of these missions that comes hurtling in really close to the sun and tries to measure in situ, like right in place, the constituents of the gases and the particles, the plasmas that are being released off of the sun, as well as it takes some fantastic pictures. So there's that. But there's a whole host of international satellites and probes that have been put up that are collaborating to collect data for this. And you know, one of my first missions was called the Upper Atmospheric Research Spacecraft, UARS, back in the early 80s. And it was launched. One of the things it did was it measured the solar proton input along the magnetic field lines to begin to understand how those particles might cause spacecraft to charge up and then maybe discharge and create sort of a static electricity problem, as well as there's physics that goes on in the atmosphere as a result. And then I don't honey, I don't think you need me to name all the names, but there was a spacecraft called Wind and a spacecraft called Polar, a collaboration with the European Space Agency called Cluster, and then the Japanese put together a mission called Geotail. And all of these missions were designed to go to different regions around the Earth and measure similar effects associated with the interaction between the sun and the Earth's magnetic field, so that we can create the models that we have today to help us predict the impact of these events and basically create the discipline of space weather. The last couple of missions that I worked on were one called SDO, and that's a mission that sits at geostationary orbit and looks at the sun in various wavelengths. And you can find those pictures today, monitoring the sun's activity in real time. And a pair of spacecraft that we sent to outside of Earth's orbit. It would, one was going to fly in front of the Earth as it goes around the sun, and the other behind the Earth. It was called Stereo. That was going to measure the interaction between the sun's magnetic field and interplanetary space by getting a sort of a 3D look, right? You know, you get that sort of binocular separation we have like with our own eyes, except for on solar system scales, you have to get much further apart. So Stereo A and Stereo B were in their journey around the sun, and I believe Stereo B has failed now. It's well past its mission lifetime, but Stereo A is still operating. So, and then even further out, the solar physics scientists have ways of utilizing the data from MAVEN. If you remember, we talked about MAVEN at Mars and how it's trying to measure the loss of atmosphere at Mars due to the solar winds. Solar wind comes along. Mars isn't protected like the Earth is from a magnetic field, and it starts slicing the atmosphere off the top. And steadily, over millions of years, you lose most of the atmosphere that Mars had. So that today, it's got a tenth of the density that Earth has. Well, that data is also useful to the solar physics folks and the space weather folks, as is the data that's being captured at Jupiter by Juno. So you can see the whole solar system becomes sort of a laboratory in understanding space weather.
Jim, if I can ask a quick stupid question. So well, it's sort of more about the reason for going to space rather than doing it on Earth. I mean, there's been solar telescopes for donkeys of years all mm-hmm. over the telescope, which mainly gives sort of white light images and maybe a little bit into the infrared and ultraviolet, I guess. And we know the atmosphere cuts off most of the others. And in Sutherland, there's an equivalent to GONG, which is the American system. The British system is called BISON, which basically measures the oscillations that the sun is having, which basically can probe right into the center of the sun. So I assume or my question is, what do you actually measure outside of the atmosphere that you can't measure down below?
Well, most importantly, you alluded to it, is the physics that you can't see due to the atmosphere here at Earth.
Okay, right? Yeah.
So you want to get up above the atmosphere, but also you want to, you know, in terms of the magnetic field, you need to actually be in the magnetic field you're trying to measure in order to measure it. Otherwise, you're measuring some other effect, like the glow from the aurora, that sort of thing. So, for an example, we sent Geotail way out past the Earth-Sun Lagrange 2 point, which is where James Webb is going, to measure how the magnetic field tapers off from the Earth. Well, that sounds pretty cool. You'd think you could measure it once and it'd be done, but it's not that simple, because the geomagnetic tail changes and shifts and shortens and separates and then reconnects based on the pressure that the sun is putting on our magnetic field at any given point in time. And of course, as I said, that's very dynamic. And so the magnetic field around the Earth shape shifts. So that's a thing that you have to measure in situ. As long as you're there, you might as well take pictures. And so in order to get some reference to what you're seeing on the ground, you also take infrared so you can relate that picture to what maybe you're seeing in Sutherland. As well as you mentioned, ultraviolet is very useful as well. And there's something to be said for having a spacecraft parked in space so that it can look at the sun at all, you know, all the time, instead of having to wait for nighttime to come around and the dome to open and that sort of thing.
So, I think, Jim, people would like to know how close to the sun should one be to do a so-called solar mission? We know Parker is quite close to the sun, but what about SDO and so on?
With today's technology, what really matters is your vantage point. And the vantage point, or I should say, the thing you're trying to measure affects the vantage point. So on SDO, Solar Dynamics Observatory, we put it at geostationary, so it could stare at the sun all the time. But what they wanted was continuous images of the disk of the sun in several different wavelengths, like we've been talking about, infrared and ultraviolet, et cetera. So that kind of made a geostationary a unique thing. The Geotail mission, for example, went way out beyond Earth, away from the sun, because that's where the dynamics associated with the magnetic field were happening. Parker Solar Probe wanted to understand the source of all of these coronal mass ejections, solar flares, and the dynamics going on in the corona itself. And so for that, they felt they needed to get up real close. And so, you know, we've built missions that are analyzing the sun, as I mentioned, all the way from right up next to it, like Solar Parker Probe, as well as far out as Juno at Jupiter. So what really matters, I guess, to double back, is the vantage point is dictated by the thing you're trying to measure. But on the on a solar system scale, these vantage points can be very far apart.
Yes, I've often wondered, looking at the sun could be quite hazardous. And if a satellite looks at the sun all the time and is exposed to the heat, isn't that a problem?
It is. And so they're designed specifically for the kind of measurement that they're making. And so the lenses have special coatings on them. Sometimes they have baffles that keep out stray light, and they're only looking at a particular feature. But if they know they're going to be looking at the sun, it's then they design the cameras and the lenses specifically to deal with that radiation. The spacecraft itself is always sitting in the sun, and so there's always a balance between how much thermal irradiance it receives versus how much it rejects to the space behind it. And so thermal engineers know how to balance that out pretty well. Another really interesting feature is there's an instrument called a coronagraph. And I believe you guys might have some coronagraphs at Sutherland as well, Billy.
Yes. Yeah, we do this on stars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like looking at the sun and holding your thumb up to cover the bright disk. And what's revealed then is the corona. It's like having an eclipse all the time.
All the time.
And that's a very specialized measurement to make in a camera that's in space. Because if you get just a little bit off and the sun peaks around that occultor, they call it, then you'll blind the camera. So we have to be very careful about the attitude control system and the size of the occultor disk and constantly monitoring that. And some of the coronagraphs that we've built are so sensitive that if it gets off and the sun becomes too bright, it automatically closes a shutter so that it protects the rest of the instrument.
Right, we have to stop there. Jim, you're available on the Facebook group.
I love answering questions on the Facebook group. It's great.
Right, Willie, jou besonderhede?
Ja, telefoonnommer 072-45-79-208. 072-45-79-208.
En dan die e-posadres van die program is sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Volgende week is ons terug. Tot dan, alles van die beste.